Handelman.
Wow, I'm being told I'm being recorded.
Just for you, sir.
This is Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch. I use he/him pronouns, and thank you.
And Mr. Handelman, the recording is outward facing, so it'll the main gist of this meeting is going to be to kind of focus us on the body-worn camera reviews of the different policies. I have kind of a comparison that I want to read out of major areas that there seems to be a little bit of agreement on, a little bit of disagreement on. And I was hoping there'd be a few more public people here, but next time. And then kind of get a sense of what areas we need to focus in on a little bit more based on the jurisdictions we've spoken with and the Department of Justice recommendations that I recently received, none of which are all that long, but they hit the main points, I think, of disagreements in the past. But as a start of this meeting, though, I did want to provide some time for Kelsey to kind of give us an update on what's happening there with, you know, perhaps the negotiations or what you're seeing there on the street.
Well, like I said, you know, I think there was a request for me to come. I'm happy to answer your guys' questions about mediation. I don't know if there was anything specific that you had discussed in previous meetings, but essentially, you know, the status of the mediation program is it's still active and ongoing. There is a contract that we have with a professional mediator that will last until the end of June. We'd had that contract set up to align with the 18-month timeline that we'd been told for this new board to get up and running. So we'd try to time our contract to end at that point. I think now with Mary's announcement this week about releasing her authority for IPR, the status of a new contract will be a topic of discussion in terms of a transition process to our moving into a new authority. And then obviously when the new board takes over, if they want to do something different with mediation, that'll be all on them. But as of right now, we are still doing mediations. We offer mediations to everybody at the intake point. And also once they've gotten their initial contact letter, and then it's also considered in every review of an intake by the case reviewer, they can consider if mediation would be a good outcome for that case. So we're still offering it. We don't have a ton of engagement with it right now, I would say. We, for a variety of reasons, which I'm happy to go into if anyone is interested in. But I think primarily, you know, it's been difficult with the pandemic. We've been doing mediations over Zoom. We were able to do one in-person mediation in the summer when things were a little bit better. But since then, it's been all exclusively on Zoom, which of course has its own barriers for access, which are not great, but doing the best we can in these times.
So what's not a ton of mediations? How many do you figure you do in a normal month or year?
In a year, we're probably doing 5. It's not a lot, yeah. Our investigators who take the intake calls often say that folks, when they're calling us, are still pretty upset by their encounter. I think a lot of the driving force behind not wanting to do mediation can be that they don't necessarily want to have another potentially upsetting encounter with the same officer. It takes folks, understandably, some time, I think, to, just some space, I think, between the incident and when they can think about wanting to talk to the officer again. With the timelines that we have, with it being just a 2-week turnaround for a lot of our intakes and trying to get the mediations done quickly, sometimes that might not be enough time for someone to make that decision. So we do try to allow them more time to make a decision about mediation and if they'd like to do it. But I think that oftentimes at the intake point, it can be a difficult time to make that decision, even though we recreate a very safe space for folks when they're in the mediation. I think that initial decision is difficult for folks.
I have a question, but I see Dan has one too. So Dan, go before me.
I appreciate that. I'm not a member of the group, but I was reading the compliance officer's report, and it just happens that last night I read the part about IPR. They list the, there's a table called table 8.4 on page 61, if you want to look at it, if you have it near you. And it lists the different outcomes of the complaints. It says mediation, number of cases in quarter three, and says six, and in parentheses it says zero. And I don't understand what that means. Can you explain that at all?
Well, I don't know. I think that I'd have to look at COGLA's report to see why they put that number in there that way. You know, I think on occasion a case might be assigned to the mediation program, and then ultimately the person decides not to do mediation, so it's rerouted to another course of action. So that could be reporting on that, that, you know, cases maybe were assigned on a mediation track but not ultimately mediated. But I'd have to check on those numbers to be sure, but I'll take a look after this.
Thank you.
I am really glad you're here. I have so many questions because this is an area of great interest to me, but I also don't want to dominate this meeting, and I can maybe reach out to you outside of this more formal context to ask the questions. But it sounds like mediation is something that is offered to the complainant, but mediation is not something that, say, the CRC could recommend as a corrective measure for an officer. Is that correct?
So yeah, I would say that, so mediation is an alternative to the appeal process. So at the close of an investigation, if it's not a forced case, the person is offered the opportunity to do mediation in lieu of, an appeal. And so I don't think it says anywhere in the code that CRC could recommend mediation at that point when you've gotten a case. I think that's an interesting idea. I think with our mediation program, the officer also has to agree to mediation. We can't force them to do it. So that's always a thing to consider with any mediation. But it's definitely not a part of code. I don't know if there's a workaround for it or not, but it is an option before it gets to the appeal.
And then is there a preparation on both ends? Is that part of the mediation contract that both parties are have some advanced preparation for the mediation to be successful? Is that part of the program?
Yeah, so our mediator that we contract with, she typically handles a lot of that case development work is what we call it. So she will talk with the complainant and in advance and try to get a sense of if they have any questions or anything that they need to know going into it or any of that stuff. I also talk to folks about those things. But it's usually more stuff comes up in the scheduling process, more questions or more prep that folks need. And so she handles a lot of that case development work herself and for the officer too.
Last question, I'm gonna be quiet. But I'm just curious if in the instances that the complainant desires mediation and the officer is not interested, do you have any number, like any relative numbers about how often that's true? And if, is that a piece of why mediation seems to be underutilized, or is it just underutilized because the complainants aren't necessarily interested?
It's very rare for an officer to decline mediation. I can think of only two instances where that's happened in my time handling the program. A benefit for the officers is that a mediation doesn't show on a discipline history. So if they do a mediation, the case number doesn't show up as part of their complaint history. It's separate. It's a separate list. It's mediation. So so it's very rare that the officer declines. It's more frequent that the complainant decides they don't want to do it or doesn't show up, isn't able to show up, something like that.
I have a question.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I have a question about the timeline and sort of the history of, I'm curious to know why it's not something that's offered after after a decision is made or after an appeal has been heard, because it seems like in terms of timing, like it's possible that, you know, there has been more time since, you know, the incident, so they might be more receptive to that. But also, you know, if the appeal isn't, or the case or, and then the appeal isn't decided in the way that the appellant, you know, likes or understood, which is so common, it would seem like that could be a ideal time for mediation. So I'm kind of curious to know why that's not, hasn't been part of the practice or the help, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if I can answer the why necessarily. You know, the mediation program was developed along with IPR. Irene, I don't know if you remember exactly when mediation started, but it's been 15 years, probably, at least.
At least, yes.
Yeah.
If I might add, Kelsey, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so of course.
The mediator that we have is absolutely incredible. She's got a lot of experience. She comes to this work from a loving and restorative heart. And she's been with us for a long, long time. And she totally understands the, she does this work through the equity lens that we all really want to strive to be. Like, she's a leader in what she does. And in terms of improvement, if I may, I think one of the things that people who are going to move this work forward can think about, and others have done this, is that build a better relationship, which is going to take time, staff time, I'm saying, and dedicated staff, because between Kelsey and I, this has been like a passion of ours, but it's so time consuming. And in order to really build it out system-wide, one of the things that Denver used to have, I don't know if they have it anymore, so don't quote me on it, is that there is a relationship between the oversight system and the police bureau, and the police bureau send in possible cases for mediation to build that relationship with the community. Now, that's not what IPR can do right now, especially where we are and the staff limitations, but that is something, if we had a gold standard, in my opinion, that we could move this work forward. And I'll stop there.
Yeah, that's been a long time goal of Irene's. She's tried so hard to get the opportunity for officers to request mediation too, and to offer it to people on the front end. I think the change that she and I worked on together that we made was having mediation be an option on the complaint form. So if somebody's filing a complaint, they can say on the front end, I'm interested in mediation. And so we can kind of, you know, fast track it to that process if that's what that person is really desiring to do. That's the best that we could do. But I do think it would be really powerful if the police bureau could also offer it on the front end. So,
And Dan says he knows the answer to my question.
Yeah, hi. So we at Portland Cop Watch actually suggested mediation under the old system, PIAC, and it existed then under Mayor Katz. I've actually went through mediation twice under that system. The reason that it's not offered at the end of the process is that it's offered to the officer, that one of the incentives is that the officer is told that if they do a mediation, they're not going to be investigated. So if they get the investigation done and go all the way through the CRC process, then the mediation doesn't have that that same weight of not having the investigation happen.
But it doesn't preclude it from being a possibility. It just makes it seem like there would be less motivation for the officer to accept it, right?
Well, that's correct. There was one case, and I, you know, it's going to take me a while to try to look it up, but there was one case where the CRC felt very frustrated by the whole, process. And I think the IPR director sent it back for mediation, even though it had been investigated. That was many years ago. It's probably almost 20 years ago, but I'll see if I can find my information on that.
Interesting.
Anybody speak to like what sort of structural change would be required to for like the CRC or an oversight body to offer or to ask for mediation as like a remedy, say in lieu of a debrief with a supervising officer?
So in terms of like sort of along with the findings, that there would also be a mediation that could be
recommended.
Yeah. It's a good question. I think that if we're talking about adding it into essentially what is findings and potentially goes into the discipline sphere, it'd have to be something that would need to be agreed upon by the police bureau. But I really, that's just an off the cuff answer. I don't have an exact one for you. And I think, I don't know if it would require a code change or not. I think with the position that we're in right now, all this stuff is going to be up in the air. but yeah, I would think that there would at least be need to be some agreement from the police bureau to add that in as an option. I know that they were working on adding into the police bureau directives an option to do internal cases as mediations. So that's when one officer makes a complaint about another officer, they can request to resolve it through mediation. So that's a new thing that they are working on internally. So they're definitely open to mediation at the police bureau and supportive of it. So.
Thanks so much.
And I don't want to take up all, I know you guys have a lot of other things to talk about in your meeting, but Jessica or anybody else that's interested in mediation, feel free to reach out to me on email and I'm happy to meet with you separately or answer any questions over the phone, by email, whatever. So anytime.
Thank you so much. Appreciate that.
Question, Kelsey, before you go, what percentage of the mediations do you think have been successful where there's a resolution?
Yeah, so the way that our mediations work, it's not necessarily about success versus not success. They're really like essentially a facilitated dialogue. So I think when, from a legal perspective, when you're thinking about a mediation, you're thinking about coming to an agreement at the end of it. And with our mediations, it's not necessarily an agreement that you come to at the end. It is a dialogue. And so we do at the end of the mediation, so have people voluntarily fill out a survey for how the experience was for them. And write on their ratings for how things went and then the option to add comments. And the vast majority of people are satisfied with having gone through mediation, even if they felt like, you know, at the end, they maybe still had a disagreement with the officer. They still felt like they understood why a decision was made or why the officer did what they did. So the vast majority are successful in that way, is that people are satisfied with the process itself.
Thank you, Kelsey.
I'd just like to
yes, say, sir.
That was my experience as well. And I assume that now your mediator, having done this for a long time, understands this better. But the mediators in both of my cases didn't understand that, and they were trying to get us to shake hands and walk away. But officers and I, in both cases, just said, okay, I heard you, I understand you, I hear where you're coming from. And we knew what we were talking about. And the mediator was a little perplexed. But I thought it was very important. And when we're teaching about the system in CopWatch, when we're teaching new people about the system, we talk about how mediation can be more effective than a debrief, which I'm glad you brought that up as an idea, to have mediation instead of a debrief. Because, you know, we don't know what the officers are being told by their supervisors. And it could just be like, oh, well, you know, I have to do this because this is what the decision was. But it's much more effective, I think, for the officer to look the person in the eye, say, this is, the person says, this is how you made me feel, and the officer has to respond to that. So I'm glad you're still doing the mediations.
Yeah, they're incredibly powerful, I think, in a lot of ways. And I think that it's a super valuable process. I wish that more people did engage with it, because I do think that happens frequently where you can just have a really informative dialogue. And I went through a mediation training program myself, and doing that, I can see where if you are a mediator that's only done a mediation where you're supposed to come to an agreement at the end, that would be your goal. And luckily, our mediator that we have now has done so many of these police community mediations that she understands what it looks like and what the goal of the program is, which really is the restorative dialogue. So yeah, she's wonderful. She teaches mediation. Like Irene said, she's comes from a peace building background and is just incredible.
Yeah, it seems like if this process works well, like we're acknowledging that there's been harm done and we're doing something to repair the harm, but punishment is not the thing, right? Punishment does not get us to accountability. And so if it seems punitive to have to talk to your supervisor about what you did wrong, it really does nothing to restore or make the person that feels like they've been harmed whole. So I am very interested in like talking more about it and lending anything that I can to moving the conversation or lending support to what you've already, I'm sure, done a lot of work around and a lot of thinking around for a long time. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Kelsey. Julie?
Oh, I was waving, but I do have a question. You could read my mind, but I was just waving goodbye to Kelsey. Thank you. That happened last night too. I realized I'm like waving, but no, I had a question that's like, I just have a question about the IPR and budget that's totally tangential.
We have time, you know, so it's a small group, so go ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering, so the budget, okay, so the fiscal year starts July 1st, right? And the budget for next year has been approved? No, when will it be approved?
We just did the mid-year budget in November, so the budget is being, I think at this point in time, probably the bureaus have submitted their proposed budgets, and then there'll be public discussions about the budget. The mayor will then propose something, there'll be public discussions, and then there'll be a vote, I think maybe in June or something like that, and then the budget will take place in July, maybe a little bit less.
So the new budget will reflect, there's the opportunity for it to reflect the change from the oversight by the auditor to oversight by whoever it falls under.
That's my understanding, but Irene, do you know any different?
You know, at this point, it feels like it's so hard to answer any questions about it, but we would be happy to ask and then get back to you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was just like wondering, even, you know, you said like you didn't know about the contract for the mediator. And so I was just wondering, like.
I think the contract is in place for, do you remember, Kelsey, when the contract expires with Louise?
Yeah, it expires at the end of June, so same time that we are supposed to leave the authority of the auditor. And the way that the contracts work with the city is that it is under the auditor's office, and so I think no matter what, a new contract would have to be, a new contract process would have to be undertaken, regardless of if we were under the auditor or anybody else.
Yeah, it's ultimately the auditor's office that does the contract, so.
Wait, the auditor's office does all the contracts, even for things that they don't directly oversee?
I don't know if you can answer that question.
Yeah, they don't. They have a process. Like there are contracts. All the contracts do go through the auditor's office for a level of review, but they aren't necessarily all handled by the auditor's office. But because we're a division of the auditor's office, our contracts are all under her authority. So anytime you're, you know, transferring authority and we'd be under somebody else, then that is where the authority would lie for that contract. So
right. That's what.
Yeah. But yes, they do have the contracts as part of their review and authority right now. Yeah.
And just to be more clear on that, because the latest developments this last week happened after the budget was submitted, there wouldn't really be a change. There would be money in the budget for the mediator and all that. So everything would go through as far as making sure that there's a mediator with IPR, no matter where it ends up.
Okay, so the budget's not going to change from what was submitted, even though it's going to be, the whole office is going to be administered in a completely different way.
We don't know for sure, but with the budget that we worked on, all of those pieces would have been accounted for and submitted.
Okay.
What happens now, it's hard to know, but as far as the operational stuff for IPR, that has all been submitted. Including meeting space for all of you and using the Portland building and any technology that CRC would need. So we made sure we submitted all of that. What happens now, we don't know. But our part was all submitted to include all of these pieces to help with mediation, support the CRC, all of those things.
And I think I missed a step also. If I recall, it goes to the chief administrative officer, and then that bureau or that office proposes their recommendations to the mayor as to what the budget will look like. And then the mayor then works with city council, and then there's a bunch of budget hearings. So now it's possible. From my standpoint, I would think that at some point in time, if there's a rescission of IPR, that money will go elsewhere probably, but I don't know who's going to be making that recommendation in the time that we have.
Yeah, it's that. It's, it's fascinating if it were only theoretical and not real.
I mean, we'll continue. I'm pretty sure about that. I don't know who we'll continue with. There's no way that I can imagine that this is going to fall apart. It's just a question of where it goes and who will want to go there. But that's my outside thoughts on that. That's not based on any conversations or anything.
But everything is subject to change, right? Like where your offices are and everything, right?
Yes. Yeah. So put yourself in that position. Like, and I've actually been in that position before in the federal government when something similar happened. It's really daunting. And I know I was looking for a different job and did get a different job, and then they pulled things together and ended up staying. But you know, you never know who's going to be your supervisor or what your job will entail, who's going to still, you know, hold those positions, or if you're going to be in that same position or a different position. I mean, everything's on the table. Everybody's functions, you know, that job classification should still remain in the salary, but what you'll be doing is likewise up in the air. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of questions here.
I'm really glad we discussed it last night, because often we don't discuss the elephant in the living room, but this elephant was so big that at least we discussed it.
Well, I'm sure we'll learn more pretty quick, but it's confusing. So let's quickly move on to the body camera stuff. I want to move it forward a little bit here. To give you some background, I received the recommendations from the Department of Justice that was sent as part of the requirements that the Justice Department gave to the city to make sure that the city's in compliance with the settlement agreement between the city and the Department of Justice involving Portland Police Bureau. And so I reviewed that. It's public record, but they submitted it to all the people involved in the lawsuit and the city attorney and the parties. Mr. Handelman, I'm sure you received that, right?
Oh yeah, it was in the Oregonian too.
Okay, that was in the Oregonian as well. So what I did was I reviewed the various testimonies or the various discussions we had with the New Orleans Police Oversight Agency, the Gresham Police, their body-worn camera people, the Beaverton Police, their body-worn camera people, and then the Justice Department and their recommendations. And I kind of tried to see where there were similarities and differences to give us, you know, a set of discussion points, because I don't think we need to create a body-worn camera policy from the ground up. You know, there's a lot that would entail, but just to, you know, perhaps weigh in on the main issues and areas of disagreement. And so here are six areas that I saw as being areas of either agreement or disagreement. There is some agreement in some of these between pretty much everybody, but these are areas that have been discussed before. So one is pre-review. Can police officers review the video footage before making a statement generally? Storage, where are these videos stored, and who, and part of that is also who gets to review them, edit them, whether it's internal, external, district attorney's office releasing it, whether like outside entities can request and stuff like that. But third is privacy. What are the constraints to using body-worn cameras? If there's a minor, if it's in a hospital setting, if there's been, you know, perhaps domestic violence, those sort of things, what are the privacy ramifications? Public release. Under what circumstances should body-worn camera footage be released to the public? So some of these agencies release like every use of deadly force to the public after a certain period of time with redactions if needed, just to get people to understand what happened. Other agencies may release other things. Some do not release anything unless there's a request for information, like a FOIA request. Next, the fifth one is when to start recording. And part of that may be when to stop recording, but the sixth is a supervisor review of body-worn camera recordings. I personally find that sixth one particularly interesting, just from my own viewpoint. When do supervisors review? Do supervisors review? Can they, you know, change policies because of that? And also, can people be disciplined just through random supervisory reviews? And there are differences there from one jurisdiction to the next. I don't know how you'd like me to go through this. I can go through like just the general jurisdictions and what their viewpoints on this is and where there's agreement or disagreement. What I'd really like to do is schedule a time, like two times in the next month, where we can meet at an alternate time where we can maybe get more community members. One maybe during daytime, one in the maybe about 6 p.m. when people are off work, and invite community members to kind of discuss this and weigh in on this. So I kind of want to put that out there for a comment in general. Like, one, do you want me to kind of go into a little bit more micro detail on these six things? And then the second is, would you be open to just opening up your calendars and finding a time right now in the next 15 minutes or something where we can send out a notice and saying, you know, let's have a meeting about this with the greater community. What do you think?
I am open to the your suggestions, meeting with the greater community. You know, at this point, I'm just curious in terms of that outreach. Is there a sort of fixed distribution list that you send out to, you know, organizations, or how does that how does it look like to engage the community?
There is, and I would appreciate your input on that. So we do have the normal CRC distribution list. And then I also, in the past, when I've held these sessions, have a larger distribution list, such as the ACLU, the Coalition of Communities of Color, the Albina Ministerial Alliance. A lot of people that come to the PSEP meetings or were part of the agreement, including the disability community, Disability Rights Oregon, but also the Amici and the lawsuit against the city, those individuals. So it's a fairly broad outreach, but it's not all inclusive. The NAACP, I try to, APANO, NAYA, but I try to get a broad swath of community members, and I'll send that to everybody as well before sending out an email to see what I'm missing. And so in the past, we have had the ACLU not participating, but observing. Reverend Haynes from the Albina Ministerial Alliance has attended some of these meetings or has sent people from there. Certainly Mr. Handelman is part of that organization, but there's another list that I send it to.
And then structurally from our office, what we could do is, if you have a date in mind, if you set the date, I will send out a MailChimp invitation, maybe, you know, a week and a half or 2 weeks in advance. So that'll give all of you time to redistribute to your contacts. That's one way to do it. Or if you all want to set it up some other way, through whatever channels you have, it's totally up in the air, and I'm here to help you.
Okay, so let me just do this then. I'm going to briefly, since we have a small group here and everybody is already well versed in the police oversight thing, I do want to kind of briefly go through these six areas, maybe in the next 5 minutes, if I can rush through them, just to give you a sense of where things are and what we've done in the past and kind of the issues. So pre-review, that is a big part of the, as I understand it, the impasse right now between the police bureau and the city and to some extent the people that are participating in their contract. It seems like everybody wants the cameras for the most part. It's just can officers review it ahead of time? The Portland Police Association wants reviewing the video before making a statement. And I think quite a few other entities want to not allow that. My personal view, and I've made this known, is I think that a statement should be made before reviewing the video, but then they can view the video afterwards and amend the statement. But it's important to get that. But that's only my personal view. I'm open to, you know, discussions and public input and any and all of this. So New Orleans, an officer can be permitted, but will not be required to review his or her own body-worn camera video prior to making a statement. So an officer can review before making a statement. Gresham does allow officers to review footage prior to making a statement. But on officer-involved shootings, they do not review the video. The video is locked down, and an officer is interviewed and does write a report. And then after that, there's a couple options as to when an officer can review the video and then add to that report. So it's a little bit bifurcated there. In Beaverton, officers write videos, then officers review the videos, then write a report. So, and officers are given 30 minutes to review the video and then speak to investigators. So a little bit of a time constraint. They want to get that mixture of, input, but also a little bit of review. Department of Justice says no review prior to writing a report. And then in the case of a Category 1 force event, after completing their required reports, a member may review body-worn camera recordings and prepare a supplemental report with additional information. So that's a distinction there. So, but there is much more distinction from what I'm read across the rest of the United States. Some jurisdictions allow the review, some do not. It just happenstance that our neighbors here do allow that review beforehand. Privacy, pretty much everyone is on board with the privacy considerations, things like minors, nudity, confidential informants, people experiencing mental health crises, sex abuse cases, things inside hospitals. These are all areas where everyone we've interviewed has something in place saying that if an officer is in those areas, they will not record, or dealing with certain types of individuals, they will not record. Storage, this is again an area where there seems to be universal agreement. Everybody that we spoke with, New Orleans, Beaverton, and Gresham, have cloud storage. They have external contractors that are in charge of storing it. So it's not the city, it's not the police bureau. There's Motorola, there's Axon. Those are a couple of the bigger ones. So Gresham has Motorola. I believe New Orleans and Beaverton have Axon. And those are kind of the big names. They have the computers, they do this kind of stuff. Everybody gets different kinds of rights. So an officer can record, but they can't edit their own footage. Most people, you know, can't view or edit. Some people can edit, but that's only like the people that would redact that information if it goes public. And then, you know, there's certain people that can access it, like in New Orleans, their version of IPR can access it, and see body-worn cameras. District attorneys can access it, but not edit. And the DOJ says body-worn camera recordings in their original form will be maintained by a third-party vendor that the city contracts with. However, the city will retain ownership and control of body-worn camera footage as required by Oregon state law. So that's the caveat, I guess. There's a law in there that says they need to own it. Don't ask me what that means in real life. But somebody else will maintain
it. Can I ask a quick clarifying question about the previous point?
Sure.
When you said there's a kind of widespread agreement around these different areas where people you would not be recording, can you clarify the mental health crisis?
Because no, that's just a note I had. It says,
I mean, it seems like a lot of officer-involved shootings, you know, take place with individuals who are having mental health crises. And so I'm just wondering, I've got to be missing something there.
Yeah, I think you're right. So here's what the New Orleans oversight person said, and we'll probably have to delve a little bit more in the code than I've done here. But she said, also consideration goes to hospitals or medical settings or people with mental health crises. And beyond that, that's why I mentioned that that's directly from what she said during our meeting. And I can look it up. I can get back to you, Julie. I'll look it up in the code on their policies and see what it says with respect to that. And I don't know whether there's a caveat there with, you know, perhaps an individual that's, you know, involved with some of the other things like nudity or something else.
Okay.
I'll look it up. It's a good point. And please, everybody, including Mr. Handelman, feel free to interrupt me because I'm just going to keep on going for the sake of time. Next is, okay, so we got through storage, public release, New Orleans, body-worn camera footage is released within 10 days for officer-involved shootings. It is unedited. And they release it to the family first. They have a conversation with the family, but they want the public to know what happened. So within 10 days, it's released to the public. Gresham, it's up to the DA. So if there's an officer-involved shooting, it's up to the DA whether to release it. Unless there's a narrative around the shooting that's erroneous, and then the police can decide to release it. And anybody in the public can make a public records request if it's for a particular footage. Beaverton, videos released to Major Crimes Division that works with the DEA on release of videos. And then public records are also allowed in accordance with Oregon law. So again, the DEA is involved as to what's released, the district attorney. And the DOJ says that, or recommends a body-worn camera recordings may be discussed without a public records request to comply, disclosed without a public records request to comply with obligations under Brady v. Maryland to facilitate joint investigations or to evaluate officer performance to the training division or as otherwise by policy. So they say that it could be released. They're not against it, but they don't say that it has to be as part of their recommendations. When to start recording, New Orleans, before an officer arrives to the scene, DOJ gives three different criteria as to when it is. They want recordings to start when automatically, so now it's all automatic as well. So when an officer draws a firearm, the camera will start recording automatically or ECW. I'm not really sure what that means, but when a member initiates pursuit and when otherwise established by policy. An officer themselves shall activate when dispatched to a call, when engaged in certain enforcement activities in contact with the public, except for, and this ties in with earlier, the sexual assault investigations, death notifications. There's a few caveats there. And the recording will start will include the coverage 30 seconds before the actual police officer starts the recording. So the camera actually is going on all the time. It's just not saving it. But when an officer starts the recording, whatever that is, the last 30 seconds are saved as well prior to that. So if an officer sees something and decides, you get more of a context than when the officer actually decides it's time. And then supervisor review of recordings. So New Orleans, and this is again what I found particularly interesting, but New Orleans supervisors review the footage just randomly. So they go through some random footage. If they see misconduct, they have to report it. And also if they see something that's can be used to change training or policy, they use it in that sort of way. They're saying that their review of body-worn camera footage through their supervisors actually results in more officer-initiated complaints than they get externally from outside sources. Gresham does not do random video checks. That's because at some point in time, they signed a memorandum of understanding, which is kind of the same thing as in their agreement with the union. It's not the contract, but they can add to it with the union to generally not use technology to do random checks. Beaverton does do random reviews, and the Department of Justice says that the city shall authorize, and that's a mandatory thing, supervisors to review body-worn camera recordings, including live-action footage for lawful management purposes. And shall authorize, likewise mandatory, the auditor's office and IPR or its successor to review camera footage for lawful auditing investigative purposes. So that's pretty strong words that they want that mandated. Doesn't say what people will do with it, but they want that ability for people to access it. So anyways, those are the main points. Any quick thoughts? And then we'll go to maybe calendars.
No, I think I really appreciate you summarizing it in that way. Thank you. It's helpful.
As far as calendars go, I'm just going to put it out there that it's very hard for me to attend meetings later in the day, but I would try my best for whatever we had. But I guess I'm still a little bit not sold on the purpose. I mean, I don't know what Dan's point was about putting these things, these other forums up there, but it seems like there have been other forums. And is the purpose to get to just as part of our process, we want to make sure that we have as much opportunity for community input as possible, or are we doing something that's already been done and maybe not as well as these other folks have done it because of time and whatnot? So actually, Dan has his hand up. Maybe he has something to say on that.
Let me just chime in with why I think this is important. So I've been on the PSEP meetings in the past, and there's been some general recommendations, but very general, like in the future, you should, you know, consider these things, but not any like holistic view of what's being done and what people are thinking about these things, and then actually saying this is the actual recommendation. I think, you know, there certainly as the policy jurisdiction of the CRC is on this. Certainly PSEP has held a listening session recently with input from people and anybody under, you know, the training division and other organizations might very well have little pieces to add to any of this. But I think it's important to, you know, now that we sort of have fleshed out what the different issues are, what other jurisdictions are doing, you know, maybe talk about what we want, what we think is working, what we think is not working, what we'd like to see, and have that put out there. So it's a little bit of both. It's kind of what the work that we would do would be in policy recommendations, but also it really fills, from what I've seen before, a pretty big hole, which is people have spoken to their need, some of these needs of like pre-review and things like that, but not sort of evaluated the pros and cons in the past. It's just been like, hey, The PSEP recommendations in the past have been like, y'all should take the consideration privacy rights, you know, but not like, here's what you should not, where it should not be or should be, or where other jurisdictions are saying should not, or and this is what we agree with and don't agree with. So we can be a little more granular, I think, at this point. Mr. Hamelman.
Thank you. My point was that I think that if you're moving forward with this, you should probably watch those videos first, because each of those links I sent, one is directly to a video, the other one has a video embedded in it, and you probably could learn a lot about any members' thoughts, maybe even about these very specific six areas that you're looking at. I personally haven't looked at either of them all the way through yet, but I saw part of the MHA one. I also had a question based, you know, kind of lingering from last night's meeting, which is that how are you sharing the information you've gathered with the crowd control and force work group, which said they're going to look at the body cameras in the context of crowd control. And connected to that, have you got that table you're just reading from in a format that you can share out? Thank you.
I do not, but definitely before, you know, within 3 or plus days of our next meeting, I'll send, you know, an agenda with those issues and pretty much exactly what I wrote out there, what I read there, but in a more succinct format that's going to be released publicly before any meeting that we have, as well as the various body-worn camera policies from all the jurisdictions and the Justice Department recommendations. To be honest, I was blindsided at the last meeting. I was not told that the other work group was going to review any of this. So we'll need to have maybe a little bit of discussion with that work group to understand what they're going. If they're just looking at the crowd control aspect of it, I don't think that there's any overlap. I mean, we're kind of very separate issues. We can work together. I had not heard anything about that until last night, and I haven't spoken with Candace this morning. But there will be conversations, I'm sure.
Okay, well, so are any of you planning to go to their meeting, which I think is next Wednesday?
For the crowd control?
Yes, that's right, yes, exactly.
I was.
I don't know if I can. I might be traveling on Wednesday, but I will try. If not, I'll view the meeting online. But thanks, Julie, for going, and Jessica, if you can.
Oh, no, I said I will not. I was sorry.
We got 3 minutes. Sorry about that. Let's see. How about next? I'll offer this as a possibility next Tuesday at 4 p.m. So Tuesday, February 8th at 4.
For a forum? Or I'm not sure what the date is for.
Yeah, for the forum.
That seems really soon.
It's too soon. Okay. Let's put it. I agree. If we need to send it out and get people involved. Let's see. Tuesday, February 15th at 4.
That's not going to work for me, but. At 4, let's see. Yeah, actually, maybe I can make that work. As long as it's just 1 hour. Is that what you're thinking about? Just 1 hour?
Just 1 hour.
I can't commit to that time. I would be happy to, I mean, if I can be there, I would be, but I can't commit to like helping to facilitate or anything like that.
Okay, that's fair enough. Jessica?
I can also try to be there. I'm curious in terms of like community involvement, if later in the evening doesn't work better for people. I know that's like pick up kids from school time and, you know, stuff. So I don't know that it's the ideal time to get the best engagement, but I could probably make it work.
I mean, for me, what makes sense when I see meetings like that is like 5:30 to 6:30. And maybe just a little more lead time so we can do really good advertising for it, but that's totally your call. And how do people feel about a noon meeting for this type of, if it's a 1 hour thing?
Well, I can make noon meetings.
Easier for me, but yeah. But I would say if the end game is to engage the community, then you probably all, Irene, I know you've been at this for a while. Probably you have sweet spots, 5:30 to 6:30.
I should have said this earlier. I'd like to have two meetings before our next noon meeting in March. Okay. And one will be an evening meeting, 5:30 to 6, 6 to 7, something along those lines. As to the daytime meetings, I'm open to it. You know, we have our noon meetings, so I was thinking about something at a different time when some people may be at work, but some people may not be at work, like a 4 o'clock. But let me know, because I'm also available at noon on most days. So if we want to have another noon meeting and then one at 5:30, that would work for me too. What do y'all think?
Sounds good to me. I apologize. I have to hop into a 1 o'clock meeting, but that sounds good to me. I appreciate all of you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye, Jessica.
Okay, so what do you think, Irene? Just maybe a couple of minutes here, if you can.
I'm a little confused. Are we talking? It sounds like we're talking about planning meetings, and we're also talking about forum meetings, right? Dates.
Two forum meetings.
Two forums, and
before
then
before our next noon meeting in March.
Oh, I see. Before March meeting.
Yeah, and one forum meeting would be in the evening, 5:30 to 6:30, 6 to 7, something like that. And one would be more of a daytime meeting, whether it's, I just proposed 4 because on that particular day it works for my schedule, but could do noon on some days. I just, whatever's better for everybody. It might matter, might not, I don't know.
Okay. I think for, I love the idea that you, they, all these organizations you presented, and what if we scheduled a Thursday evening on the 17th? And that way I could send out the presser, like maybe even Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, on the 8th. And that'll give us a lot of time to advertise it. And okay. Maybe
except I can't do the evening of the 17th. I have both a charter commission and
okay.
Have back-to-back meetings from 6 till, unless it's like 5 to 8, I have back-to-back 3 meetings.
Okay. And you said one earlier in the day.
Yeah. I was thinking try to get the daytime crowd and then an evening crowd. So Wednesday the 16th, my schedule's fairly open. Tuesday, in and out, but I could do a noon or that 4. Thursday, February 17th is not available that much. Well, daytime it is.
Okay, let's go back to, you said 16th is more available during the day, during like a 4 o'clock or a noon?
Yeah, the 16th I can do either noon or like 4:30. Or later. Or I could do a 4. I could push that back. The 16th noon or 4.
Okay, let's work on like an evening and a day. How about that? How about we do the 16th at noon and then an evening one on the 22nd? Because okay. That'll give us time to really advertise this.
Okay.
Or is that too far?
No, it's not too far. There's a PSEP meeting on the 22nd. So we're going to have.
Oh, got it. How about the 23rd? It's another Wednesday.
Yeah, evening works for me.
Okay. So 16th at noon and then 23rd at 5:30.
And I want to make sure that everybody else is kind of cool generally. I know Julia said, Julia, you might be able to know not, but how do those dates sound?
I know we're just like running over.
They're not definite blackout dates.
and Mr. Handelman, I know your schedule is pretty busy, but are those possible for you or your people?
I cannot say, everything's up in the air. Even the Police Accountability Commission is changing what days we're meeting all the time. So, but don't schedule around me. I'll let people know once you send your announcement out.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hamilton.
How about this, Vadim? How about we, like these dates that we just talked about, how about we send them to the full CRC and see who else can support it and be there? If it sounds like this is the 16th might work for you, Julie, because noons are better. Noons are better. And what do you think about that? And see who else can support it. Or do you want to just book them and move forward?
I don't see any problem. We need as many people as possible, certainly from the CRC. So if you can send it out, hopefully Jessica will be able to attend. We need our core group here. But I think we're also missing a member. So yeah, that's a good idea. Thanks.
So do you want to send it or should I send it?
If you can send it, that'd be great.
Okay.
And then as long as there's no definite no's or I object or something along those lines that we need to encounter, let's just go ahead and send the notices out as soon as possible. And that'll help fix things in my schedule.
Julie, does that work for you?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Great.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it would be great. Did anyone hear from Shayna before this meeting? I know she couldn't make last meeting because of
No.
Yeah. Okay.